Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best Dr. Seuss book ever. And to maybe learn something along the way.
I don't think you never learn anything, so I don't know why you would hope for that.
No, I don't never not learn anything. To help me are two people, Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I am a high school English teacher. Nick, just out of curiosity, what kind of book are you looking for this week?
A Dr. Seuss book, of course. Did I say that?
You did.
I said it. I think I did.
You did. I was listening for it.
All right.
Get in the game, Joe.
All right. I'm sorry. Nick, my name is Joe Holshue. And this week, if you are looking for a Dr. Seuss book, it's a little surprising. It's not what you might expect. I have a compilation of Dr. Seuss wartime comics, World War II, of course, called Dr. Seuss Goes to War.
Oh, no.
All the comics are written in 1941 and 1942.
Oh, no.
The book itself was compiled in 2001.
Oh, no.
Nick, you need to strap in for this because it is a wild ride of anti-Japanese sentiment.
Oh, there is. Nick, I'm not going to lie. There's some anti-Japanese sentiment.
Of course there is. Of course there is. This is going to be terrible. Ian, do you
Hello.
Have a...
Welcome to Nick and Joe Yell About Anti-Japanese Sentiment, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ian DeYoung. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book, a Dr. Seuss book, a book by Dr. Seuss, a book in honor of his impending birthday, I would recommend the book that started it all, The Lorax. And by started it all, I mean it was one of the later books in his illustrious career.
That was the most generous use of started it all I've ever heard.
Happy birthday, Dr. Seuss.
Happy birthday, Dr. Seuss.
Strap in, Dr. Seuss.
We're going to rake through the skeletons in your closet today, Doctor.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
All right, let's just start with it. Was he a real doctor? Or was he a fake one like Ian?
I do have an answer to that question. Ian, do you want to field it?
Go for it.
All right. When he started going by doctor, he was not a real doctor. However, later in life, he was awarded several honorary doctorates, which means
Terrible.
That later in life, he still was not a real doctor.
Why do we give that out?
Well, okay, for the honorary doctorate.
Honorary doctorate?
It's a way for a university to tell their commencement speaker, we value you. I mean, we'll give you your huge honorarium, but also, here, have an honorary doctorate.
I thought it was like just bait to get them to come to be a commencement speaker.
The good thing about this is that sometimes they do have athletes do it. So we get things like Dr. Hank Aaron or Dr. Brett Favre, and that's just wonderful to say.
That is a lot of fun.
Dr. Brett Favre was my favorite quarterback.
Dr. Brett Favre. Guys, I want to say to you, happy National Read Across America Day. It's tomorrow. By which, of course, I mean March 2nd, the birthday of our esteemed doctor in question, Dr. Seuss.
And Nick, it was chosen because it was Dr. Seuss's birthday, or at least that's how it was marketed. But yeah, they chose Dr. Seuss's birthday to be Read Across America Day. Isn't that nice?
That is nice. Before you guys tell me about your books, I just want to go over a couple show rules. Here at You Don't Know Lit, we pick a theme every week and we bring two books. And what do we do with them, Ian?
We throw them into a restrictive cage, give them medieval pikes, and make them chop at each other until they're both tattered and torn.
Mm-hmm. And of course, two books enter, one book leaves. It is book club meets fight club. You Don't Know Lit, lit heads. This is what you're here for.
Mm-hmm. I think it's more like Fight Club meets Book Club, actually.
Mm-hmm, that. So we do have some show rules. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe, or worlds, Either one.
Also, Joe, you've been putting a lot of needless worlds into your your turn.
Just really goes on and on.
Sorry.
Yeah. And rule number three, winning isn't everything.
Jesus.
Choked up.
I got a real frog
He's
over here.
He's getting choked up about how winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Folks, litheads, you may not know this, but Nick takes this extremely seriously. Sometimes,
yes.
Sometimes his family comes down to his editing booth and finds him slumped over his editing computer machine, weeping because he cares so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I picture after every episode you guys lose that you just kind of, you have to like sulk up to the living room where your wife has been patiently waiting and she goes, "Did you win?" And you go, "No."
I'm slightly curious about your post-recording rituals. Does your wife ask you if you won or lost, Ian?
She does.
Mine does too.
Yeah, of course.
I kind of think my spouse is living vicariously through this. It's a little bit concerning.
Okay.
Yeah, no. My wife also asked me if I win. And guys, I'm not going to lie. When I tell her I won, she's a little proud of me. She's a little prouder of me than I would like.
She knows that she married a guy who can win podcasts.
Who can win podcasts. I can also win pickleball. And increasingly, I can win intermediate ranked chess matches. So got a lot going on for me. Yeah.
There's no way you can win intermediate.
Intermediate. No. Yep.
Is that like the definition of some website you play on? Like intermediate level?
It's chess.com. So it's not some website. It's the website for chess.
Well, it's
the
same
website Magnus Carlsen plays on.
This is going to be like the secondary story, the secondary story arc for this podcast. Joe gradually becoming a grand wizard of chess. Is that what you call him? Grand wizard?
Yes. It is chess and the Ku Klux Klan that you are the grand wizard of when you get really good at it.
Very confusing. Get those mixed up.
Well, they're just as lame. Joe, do you want to tell me about your book?
Absolutely.
Tell me about your book. Now you kind of, you're breaking some rules, I think, with this one.
Yeah, it's pushing the envelope. All right, Nick. I've composed a poem. I've composed a rhyme.
Oh, yes.
Nick.
Oh.
Dr. Seuss goes to war with Seuss before Seuss. It's his earliest work. It's acute, not obtuse. It lampoons Adolf Hitler, Hirohito, and more. Charles Lindbergh, Benito, ere the Second World War. It's cutting, it's scathing, intelligent too. It collects all his work from 4-1 through 4-2. Why stop there, you might ask, when the real war went longer? Because that's when he joined to make real propaganda. So Nick and Litheads, listen here if you please, and Ian, if you could please stop trembling your knees. I've come here to fight, to talk Seuss, and to win. It's the best book I've brought since Huckleberry Finn.
I brought Huckleberry Finn. And also, that's amazing. Well done.
In true form.
I have no poem.
Now, normally you rhyme, Ian.
Yes.
So how do you feel right now?
I feel small. Reduced. I feel like I should be doing...
Ready to sulk upstairs.
I feel like I should be doing Horton Hears the Who because I feel like the small speck of dust there, but I'm not. Okay, to summarize my book in one sentence, here it is. A child learns about the ecological dangers of resource depletion. Sounds fun, right? But Dr. Seuss and the Lorax, 64 pages, published 1971, is one of his best-loved works, harnessing his anger at human-caused ecological disaster into a funny, colorful, and persuasive argument against careless use of the natural world.
I think I'd like to build a solid foundation for this author. Joe, how concerned should me and the loyal Litheads be about how much you're going to ruin Dr. Seuss for us?
Is he going
to turn out to be a hero of the story?
I think you should not be concerned. He is going to be a hero in this story.
Is this like a Alex Trebek situation where you're like, yeah, he's actually okay, but then he's yelling at people about their women?
Yeah.
No, my take on Dr. Seuss is surprisingly not that racist. Like, my take on Dr. Seuss is this guy is on the right side of history. Mostly.
Oh my God. Mostly. Now, this is just Litheads, as a reminder, this is coming from the guy who just drug poor Alex Trebek over the coals and just painted a picture of a real monster. So,
you know, you want me to review a book? I'm here to review books. I don't
All right, truth. Joe. What's this book about?
All right. Well, Nick, as you can tell from my early rhyme, this book is a collection of Dr. Seuss's pre-World War II political cartoons that were published. He published them super regularly over the course of about 2 years. It was almost all of 1941. He started in January of 1941, publishing in a magazine. It went in all the way through 1942, and his final publications were in 1943, January of 1943, at which point he stopped drawing political cartoons because he enlisted in the U.S. Army in the propaganda division, and he spent the entire war making films and cartoons that more like cinema stuff for troops and back home propaganda.
Okay, you spit out a couple dates, a lot of dates. Just so I understand the timeline here.
Yes.
When was he? I assume like all of his greatest hits were like kind of hitting one after the other, right? Like he must have had his prime writing time. Like, when was all this other stuff happening? Was this before that, after that? Was like, am I completely wrong about that?
He didn't have like a good period and a bad period. My sense is like he dropped some really good books kind of across his career.
His war propaganda, his war political cartoons were more or less before his children's book career. His children's book career mostly came after this, like firmly after this. His children's book career was sprawling, like it lasted his entire life. And I agree with Ian that it was kind of peppered with hits.
Peppered. All right.
Peppered. There's a lot of Dr. Seuss that you haven't heard of, I guess, is one thing that I learned. Like a lot of Dr. Seuss that I've never seen before. But like sprinkled among that is The Cat in the Hat and The Lorax and Horton Hears a Who and all the classics.
The hits. The greatest hits. Did he always have this look? He does all the illustrations, right?
Yes, he illustrates all of this. That's a good question. It's actually one of my three things that I think you might be interested in here. When you read this book, one of the things that's really cool is even though this is really, really, really early Dr. Seuss, from page one, it is unmistakably Dr. Seuss. Like if you knew nothing else about it, if you never knew that he did war propaganda, you would open this up and be like, whoa, this war propagandist like is really ripping off Dr. Seuss.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Even like throughout this, this book's about like 250 pages of his cartoons, which A is super prolific, but B, as you page through this, you actually recognize characters that show up later in Dr. Seuss. Like you recognize characters like there is, when he's drawing these cartoons, there is, if he ever wants to represent India, he draws it as an elephant. Like he draws India as an elephant. That elephant is Horton. That is who the elephant is. Like it is Horton from Horton Hears a Who, which he would not draw for years and years later.
So is this a compilation book of just like a bunch of like,
yep.
Okay. I don't know. What's the,
is it making an argument? Does it have a point? Or is it just like, hey,
what's
you should
happening
know
these- in this book, yeah. Joe?
So more or less it is a collection. The guy who wrote it, one second. I need to find his name.
Dr. Seuss.
Nope.
Oh wait, he didn't write it?
Well, he created the content, which is collected, I guess. But
oh, you mean the like the publisher, the editor, I suppose. Producer.
Yeah, this book was put together by a guy named Richard Minier, something along those lines. But Richard mostly collected the work here. There is some writing in it. There's a handful of essays. Like I want to say there's like three longish essays throughout it, you know, ranging anywhere from, like 4 pages to maybe 15 pages that intersperse this work, leading into various periods of Seuss's kind of pre-war propaganda career. It adds something. They're relatively interesting to read. The guy is literary. He does have a take on it. He talks about like different themes, different motifs, like different ways that we could like look at this to track Dr. Seuss's sentiments and thinking. But the reality is you don't need to read any of that stuff. Like when you read through this, this collection of cartoons, it kind of tells the story for you. Like nobody needs to tell you what Dr. Seuss's sentiments are when you read the cartoons from this era, because they are obvious.
For people who don't have it in front of us, where it is less obvious, give us a taste. Like what are the cartoons?
So the cartoons start well before the United States is ever involved in the war. At the time, like Adolf Hitler is being pretty devious over in Europe. And the United States has a pretty firmly isolationist policy, which basically means like, hey, there's problems over in Europe. We're not going to get involved. Not our jam. Yeah, they'll figure it out. Like they're
glad they learned from that.
They're just figuring stuff out, right? And really from page one of this book, well, there's like a 20-page introduction. From page 21 of this book, Dr. Seuss is vehemently anti-isolationist. He draws like there's tons of comics about the perils of isolationism. There's comics of like this bird, like this woodpecker, Germany pecking down all the trees in the forest, and the United States sitting up on their tree and saying, boy, I'm glad he's going to be finished soon, right? Like it is firmly anti-isolationist.
Is this book worth reading, Joe? Are you really putting your best foot forward? The book I should read about Dr. Seuss?
Can I ask a like a changing of that question a little bit? Mm-hmm.
I suppose.
Build on it?
I will allow it.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me build on your question, Nick. Joe, how should we read this? Like what does one do to read this to benefit from it? Like with a classic Dr. Seuss, you read it, maybe read it to a kid and you're like, oh wow, look at the rhymes. It's a fun time. Like, what do you do with this book? Do you like leaf through it and say, interesting? Or do you sit down and read all 250 pages top to bottom?
I think the first value of this book is a purely aesthetic one. It would be really cool to buy this book, put it on your coffee table, and when people come over and flip through, they'll go, hey, this war propaganda really looks like Dr. Seuss drew it.
It's a conversation
funny
piece.
You ask.
It's so like to start with, it's a conversation piece.
Isn't that what most books are for, really, though?
Oh, right.
Clearly.
The second way that I think this book is valuable is to do exactly what Ian said, which is start at the beginning and read 250 pages through, right? Like just kind of go through this, read through it. It's, as you can imagine, there's like one picture on every page. It's a pretty quick read.
It's a cartoon.
Is this a cartoon? But yeah, it's a cartoon. It's a cartoon. If you flip it, it's a flip book. Well, not really.
You can flip any book.
Any book is a flip book.
Any book is a flip book if you try hard enough.
We've talked in previous weeks about... really, really battened down the hatches in the matter of poop books. Several weeks ago, we talked about poop books. And I'm wondering...
Now, Ian, what's a poop book?
Well, so you, as we all recall, apparently Nick and I grew up in... underprivileged households because we couldn't have poop books. But fancy people like Joe, when they weren't busy pulling plugs of pus out of cow's sides, would go to the commode, the John, and they would sit there doing number two, and they would grab a book from the back of the toilet and read it to, I guess, ease the passage of their fecus. I don't know quite what the deal is. But the idea
they didn't have Instagram at the Whole Shoe residence.
No,
at the very slow farm, internet. There was no
very
Instagram.
Slow internet at the Whole Shoe
Instagram
farm.
Instagram free, but I know a lot of poop books are comic books or books of collections of comic strips, like Calvin and Hobbes type situation. Is this could this sit behind your
some of the
toilet
greats.
Collecting fecal spray?
Yeah, that was a really long way to ask that question. Is this
unbelievably
a book?
Long?
The answer is yeah, it absolutely is. This would be a great book, litheads, to just put in your bathroom and just let guests discover, you know, maybe put it in that bathroom that's far away from the gathering area that
you know
guests
what?
Sneak away to at parties.
Yeah, hell yeah. They don't guess what? It's not all Hemingway. It's not all Hemingway. Absolutely. It's not all Shakespeare. Sometimes you just need to have a good poop book. So what's the controversy? Is he a racist or not?
Yeah. So here's the, okay, this is the closest that we come to controversy. This is my best thing. My number one takeaway from this book is, for the first time maybe ever on this podcast, we have an author who has mostly aged on the right side of history. And I think one of...
I don't think that's an accurate statement. Keep going.
One of the things that's really fun about reading this book is... I think this podcast has conditioned me over the 35 weeks or whatever that we've been doing it. And I think as I read books by authors and as I research, I just keep expecting to be disappointed in them. Like I just keep expecting to be like, oh God, how is this guy going to let me down? Or what am I going to have to justify this week when I go to talk about? Yeah. When you read this book, it is filled with cartoons that rail against isolationism. They rail against racism. They rail against anti-Semitism. They rail against Jim Crow policies in the army. Like it is for 1941, it is incredibly progressive. And it's really, really, really refreshing to read.
Joe, I have a question.
Yep.
Ian brought a book once and I forget what it was, but we said, I think it was Heart of Darkness. We were like, what were the intentions though?
Yep.
It's just a little unclear. Like, when you say rail, is he really railing or is this like, is it maybe a little racist? Could it be interpreted as racist?
Number one, could it be interpreted as racist? I don't know. It's like, if you're talking about like a below the surface interpretation.
Okay. Fair enough. Hey, you know what? We don't have all the answers. I don't know.
If you're talking a below the surface interpretation, could somebody write their PhD dissertation on this and make an argument for this as a secretly racist book? That's what we're asking about. Is this secretly racist?
Well, yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I'm going to say
it's a paid gig, right?
Yeah, it's a paid gig. You know, Seuss had a pretty good quote where he said, look, my entire life, I was not political. Like, I did not care about politics at all until Adolf Hitler showed up. When Adolf Hitler showed up, I was suddenly incredibly political. People I started suddenly caring a whole bunch.
Radicalized a lot of folks, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is this subtly racist? I don't know. Maybe there's a dissertation in there, but it is overtly pretty racist toward one specific group of people, and that is Japanese Americans.
Okay.
Gotcha. Not just like Japanese people who are from Japan and are attacking in the Pacific theater. No, Japanese Americans?
Yeah. So, Geisel, Dr. Seuss here, he is extremely in favor of Japanese internment. Like super in favor of it. Like, he thinks
why did it take so long to get here?
Well, I thought maybe I'd run out of time. Yeah, he's super he has a pretty striking cartoon, one that shows up quite a bit when this book is discussed, where it is a line of Japanese people at an internment camp, like collecting their rations, right? Collecting their food rations or whatever it is. But all of their rations are a stick of dynamite, right? So at the window, they're passing all of these Japanese Americans a stick of dynamite, a stick of dynamite, a stick of dynamite. And there's one Japanese man on the top of the hut looking back towards Japan with a telescope. And the caption is waiting for a signal from home. Like he saw Japanese Americans in America as a genuine threat to national security. And he wrote at times basically saying like, look, if you don't think these people are a threat, you are nuts. Like you absolutely are nuts.
Okay. I am going to ask a question I should have asked earlier, much, much, much earlier. So these are quote unquote propaganda books. What can you explain the relationship? You didn't explain the relationship between how much this is his word and how much he's getting paid by the government.
Oh, I'm sorry. So everything that he published. And this is a collection of publications that he had during this 3-year period. So this was all published in the same newspaper. He was like a staff writer for this newspaper, and he would draw their weekly cartoon or their daily cartoon or whatever it was. He did all of this not under government contract. It is a collection of 1941, 1942, and the beginning of 1943.
Sorry, Doc. I tried to help you out there.
Yeah, so no, this is not under government contract. The cartoons stop in 1943 because that's when he joins the army and starts making literal actual propaganda. He's an issues-oriented writer, and this book contains nuggets of so much of that. When we talk about the Sneetches is about racial equality. The Butter Battle book is about like the arms race. Yertle the Turtle is about Adolf Hitler and anti-authoritism. But later in his career, he writes a book called Horton Hears a Who, which is, I think, why I keep bringing that up as a reference. In part, this book is written as a way of apologizing to the Japanese. And I have a couple pieces of evidence for that.
Your evidence or evidence you found from...
Evidence I found.
More trustworthy sources.
Right. Number one, it is dedicated to a Japanese friend of his. Right?
Oh, he had like Japanese friends. It's okay.
He had a Japanese friend.
Some of his best friends are Japanese.
It's cool, man. I got a Japanese friend.
Number two, just like... Ian's about to tell us about the Lorax and environmentalism, you can read Horton Hears a Who as a parable for the invasion of Japan or for the U.S. attacks on Japan and Japanese internment. So when he says, for example, a person's a person, no matter how small, you can read it as like us as a criticism of the United States taking away the rights of these Japanese Americans during World War II as we interned them, right? And here, Seuss, years later, right, says, look, 1954, a person's a person no matter how small. So that, hey, that stuff that I was writing, you know, 15 years ago, 12 years ago at this point, I've had time to reconsider. When you read about his pro-internment, when you read about his anti-Japanese American sentiments, this is something that frequently comes up. Is it says, look, was
he
pro-internment?
Sorry.
Yeah, but he said I'm sorry. And I don't know. I actually give a lot of weight to that. I like, this is something that he writes, you know, he writes this book 15 years later. And I tell my students all the time, I said, look, when you look back at yourself 10 years ago, when you look back at yourself 15 years ago, not only should you not recognize that person, I don't even think you should like that person. Like you should, if you look back and don't recognize yourself, I think it's a sign of growth. So I don't know. I give props to Dr. Seuss here. I think this is pretty cool. I think he does a good job. I think he has come down on the right side of history, you know, for the most part.
Okay. Take it slowly. This book is dangerous. Fox socks, box knocks, knocks in box and fox in socks, knocks on fox and socks in box, socks on knocks and knocks in box.
Joining us for today is Wes Tank. Wes is the host of the kids show Story Raps on Kadoodle TV, where he mixes kids books and rapping and makes it accessible for all the people out there who are doing, I think, online learning and looking to entertain their children as much as possible throughout the day. I think, is that fair, Wes, to say?
Yeah, that's great. That's definitely what we aim to do. Okay.
Edutainment. There it is.
We try to get a little lesson in there and keep it fun and rappy. Got a lot of kind of, you know, danceable old school type rap beats, and but then everything's kind of calls back to fairy tales, classic stuff, and different children's books that you're going to recognize, but we always put a little modern spin on it.
Here on You Don't Know Lit, Wes, we'd like to call it secret learning. Would you say there's a lot of secret learning that takes place on Story Raps?
Secret
just to
learning.
To clarify
well, secret learning.
Yes.
Yeah, what can you define that?
This is like when you read a book and then you get done with it and you're like, oh, I just learned something like about history or about humanity.
And like the key point is you don't know that you're learning. And then after the media has been consumed, you're like, oh, and sometimes it's like oh crap, I didn't want to learn, but now I did.
Yeah.
You kind of get tricked.
It's like you think you're eating candy, but there's like some broccoli inside of it, except it tastes good. That would taste bad, but it's it.
Secret broccoli.
Secret lemon.
Broccoli.
Yeah. I guess it's like if you have like vitamins in a gummy type of thing.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Wes.
Yes.
Tell us about how you got into story reps, because I think it's a pretty interesting story, and it's how we heard about you.
Yeah. So story reps came about because I started a YouTube series called Dr. Seuss Raps Over Dr. Dre Beats, which is what it sounds like.
Is what it sounds like.
I had been doing those raps for a while in like live shows and stuff. And when quarantine hit and my video production company kind of went on pause, I was sort of alone in my house with lots of cameras and decided to make some recordings of myself rapping these Dr. Seuss raps over Dr. Dre beats that I had been developing over several years and kind of started posting them week by week. And as I was posting them, like they sort of shot up the charts. They went on to Reddit and like went up really fast on Reddit. And we were trending on the front page of YouTube. And then started getting like a lot of national and international news outlets, you know, just like true blue viral stuff. So ended up getting to around 10 million views between the like seven different videos. And Canoodle TV was a fan of the videos and they reached out and they were like, we want to do a show with you guys or with you. It was just me. It was just me at the time. But then after that, I kind of started to develop because I wasn't going to be performing the Dr. Seuss books anymore. It was going to be original reinterpretations of old fairy tales and stuff.
Did that team include Dr. Dre or no? Was he
Dr. Dre?
Good question.
You know, he was kind of in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
More of a
hype man at this point.
Yes. Like. Yes. He couldn't be in the studio, right. I guess. You know, but he was always in our hearts for sure.
It's Dr. Seuss week.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh. It's party.
How do you get down?
I really want to go on tour. If it wasn't COVID happening still right now, I would be on tour doing Dr. Seuss books.
This is like your week.
Yeah.
This is like your entire life revolves around planning for this week.
It's like if you were a shark and it was Shark Week.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's a great question, Ian. So
what's the question, Nick? Are you a shark?
Wes, can we put you on the record right now here on You Don't Owlet? Are you a shark?
No, you don't have to answer.
You don't have to answer that.
I cannot confirm or deny.
Oh crap!
Boy, I think Ian and Joe might have more great questions like that. But my question was just going to be: it's Dr. Seuss week. It's his birthday next week, and it's also what is it? National Reading Day, right?
Read Across America.
And Dr. Seuss was was very big proponent of literacy and stuff, especially with children. You know, like Cat in the Hat was written with like a very highly specific, like Random House just gave him a list of words and they were like, can you make a book that contains all of these words? Because we want to teach them to preschoolers.
Wow.
And
what,
so he made
Cat in the Hat. Of his like dominance in the field at that point, like a publishing company comes to him and says, hey, we want you to create the base text for teaching kids to read. We want you to, we're like proactively saying you are the person that we are calling upon to do this. Like, that's insane.
Dude, talk about secret learning. Like, that was the original secret learning. Like,
there it is.
He made it so much fun to like learn all those words, and you didn't even know you were learning them. You know, there was, you know, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. Like, you're learning numbers,
right,
colors, an animal. I don't know. They're like, you're just, it's all coming at you, and you don't really like even realize how much you're learning.
What are some books that you're picking out and sharing with your kids that they're really adapting to, that you feel like are still maybe relevant and like interesting to share with people?
Well, I guess the first one I would say off the top is a book called Oh, the Things We're For.
Okay.
By Inosanto Nagara. And he's a really cool guy who wrote A is for Activist, mm-hmm, and M is for Movement, and some of these other children's books that are about social justice. And Oh, the Things We're For is like essentially based on the places you'll go.
Yeah.
By Seuss. And he kind of flips that and makes it about activism and just like very social justice themes. He reached out to me about doing a video about that. So that's probably going to happen at some point.
Awesome.
So like Dr. Seuss becomes kind of a launching point for bigger topics or what?
Yeah. It's like kind of like what we do with story wraps, like where we take something that's familiar and make it about what's happening right now, taking something that's familiar and nostalgic and comfortable, and then, you know, pushing the envelope on the side on a secret learning tip.
Do you think people are going to be reading Dr. Seuss 100 years from now? And if so, like what will be, we talk about literature on this podcast and like what makes something lasting. Do you feel like Dr. Seuss is going to last? And if so, why?
I mean, it's lasted many decades already. I mean, some of it dates back to the 50s. So we're talking, some of it already has lasted almost 100 years.
True.
As long as there are kids that are learning language, English language, and people who like colorful, beautiful drawings, you know, that's their art. I mean, like we rest on the words a lot, but like his drawings are absolute art as well.
Well, and I think there's something when you listen to, when you read Dr. Seuss, when you look at those drawings, when you listen to, you know, it's like Mother Goose or like your raps, like it's undeniable. You used the word joy before, where it's just like you feel, you know, you read Dr. Seuss, you listen to one of your videos, you watch one of your videos, and it's just like this, almost like this love coming across, right? Which is just this pure joy. It's fantastic. It's contagious.
Yeah. I mean, they're very, it's all very catchy. And, you know, I think that like what I did was I tried to, you know, sort of translate it to a more modern era, but like it didn't need that, you know, it pops off the page, like, you know, without any assistance. It was all about joy, and
sure,
it really gave people a lot of joy. The comments on like my original videos that I uploaded like were just so overjoyous and like kind, and thank you. And I was afraid when I posted it out that I would get trolled, but yeah. People were like, it was the opposite of that. I was like, this is the nicest thing I've ever seen, like response on the internet to something. It was heartening.
You do these kind of, I guess, I don't know what the words you would use, but these kind of like sessions, right? With, I don't know if you have a Patreon or something, if that's how people sign up, but like you do these kind of they're not necessarily one-on-one sessions, but like a group of kids like show up and you kind of, you kind of live perform, what you do. Are there any particular books that like the kids love every time, or any particular books that, that you're rapping these days?
There's one that I'm really stoked to, perform, and I've tested it on a couple of different audiences, and it's great. It's like super lesser known, but it's called A House Is a House For Me.
Okay.
And it's very it's kind of got a Seuss vibe. It's all rhyming. It's by Marianne Hopperman, but the drawings in it are just like detailed and gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, a shell is a dwelling for a shellfish, for oysters and lobsters and clams. Each snail has a shell for and a turtle as well, but not any lions or lambs. Lions live out in the open. Monkeys live in a tree. Hippos down in a river. Now, what do you know about me? And it's all nice. Like a house. But this was recommended to me by a Patreon subscriber. One of the things that I offer on my Patreon is to do a live Zoom call where I'll perform books for your family. And then I do these monthly Zooms where I perform from the museum, from the Betty Brin. And this is the one I'm doing this time.
Wes, if the fine people out there would like to hear some of these raps, how would they find them?
These raps are on Kadoodle TV. West Tank Story Raps is the name of the show. They're also available on my YouTube page, which is West Tank. And yeah, and I'm also rapping on TikTok now. I've been rapping Shel Silverstein and Shakespeare.
Wait, what?
You just spoke to both of our hearts.
Yeah. So
I'm a big Shakespeare fan. This is super exciting.
Wes, Ian is basically a Shakespeare doctor. Don't quote me on this. Would you
Dr. Shakespeare?
Yeah, that's what we call
Dr. Ian, Shakespeare.
Ian,
I presume.
Ian Shakespeare.
maybe we could have you back to talk about Shakespeare raps one day.
Ooh. That sounds amazing.
It's just hard to even say it. That's my
Ian raps sometimes on our show, but I think
we usually cut it out.
Yeah. It's thoroughly dreadful.
It seldom makes the final cut.
I have like, it's not an absence of rhythm, it's like the opposite of rhythm.
We keep trying to put it over classical music too, and it's just he doesn't hit the beat right, and it's not great.
Well, hey Wes, thank you for joining us as our honorary first guest ever.
Oh, awesome, Wes. Yes. You guys are tons of fun.
It's great.
Thanks for hanging out, Wes.
Hey, Wes.
All right, peace. Fox and socks. Fox
and socks. Fox and socks, our game is done, sir. Thank you for a lot of fun, sir. Fox.
Ian, do you have an actual Dr. Seuss book?
Yeah, I do.
That you brought?
I do.
Oh, great. Thanks, Ian.
I brought the Lorax.
I would just like to take this opportunity to point out that my book is written almost entirely by Dr. Seuss. The other guy wrote like two essays.
Your time is over.
I'd just like to take this moment to point out that my book is written entirely by Dr. Seuss. So. No, almost. Yes, I brought the Lorax. I think this is a wonderful book, and I learned a lot about Seuss, or Theodore Geisel, as his real name is, and about American culture with this book too. So I thought we would maybe start with a game, if you guys are okay with that.
I think I'll maybe start with a one-star review, if you guys are okay with that.
Okay.
Well, who gets to make the decision? Because maybe I want to start with something, guys. Nick, Dr. Seuss's first book was called The Pocketbook of Boners.
Don't laugh with him. Just let him Oh. Let him out there. Let him float right. out and Let to see by himself.
So his first book was called The Pocketbook of Boners. We, of course, know boners as a slang term for
as an erection. Thank you, Joe. Oh, that's I couldn't put my finger on it. Oh,
however, boy. At the time, it just meant a silly mistake. Really? It was a book of 22 illustrations of blunders drawn by Dr. Seuss. The rest of the volume was like short jokes and humorous observations. That might sound like a stupid book. It reached number one on the New York Times nonfiction list. Later that year, he published a book called More Boners.
This can't be real.
It is. It is. All right, you're done, Joe. You're done. Your segment has been cut short.
Facts
we don't want them. We don't want your dirty facts. I got a one-star review.
Please.
Dr. Seuss's writing style is phenomenal, but this book brings out a very strong environmental message, of which I did not appreciate.
Political.
Okay, Hannah. Isn't this like a pro-environment book?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, Hannah is showing her hand here a little bit.
That's what she doesn't appreciate.
Hannah?
Yeah.
Are you anti-environment? It's not like this book is getting into like super specific topics where you could like debate them. Like, isn't it like, yeah, the environment's a good thing. You should take care of it.
Right. Like most of the time people say they're like pro cheap energy.
I don't like this environment stuff. It's really interesting though. I'm sorry. Are you done with that? Can I talk about this?
Yeah, I'm done with Hannah.
Okay. Hannah's done. This is I would say the ultimate secret learning book for kids, because if you're a kid, you might not realize that you're learning about resource depletion and ecological collapse, but the ecological message is clear. Dr. Seuss famously wrote this. He said he was angry when he wrote it. It ended up being one of his favorite books, and not everybody was on board with this message. So one of my favorite things I discovered about this book, about The Lorax, in my research, was the masterpiece response by someone named Terry Burkett. You guys know this name?
I don't.
No. Know this name, Terry
Burkett.
Terry Burkett. Well, it's not surprising because she really only ever wrote the one thing. She was an active member of the hardwood flooring industry, and she wrote a book called, are you ready? The book was called Truax. This book involved a grouchy forest guardian named Guardbark being convinced of the benefits of logging by a logger.
By a logger.
Oh!
Yeah.
And so she kind of responds to the whole environment message with her own. And it's fascinating because this book is written in the style of Dr. Seuss with the rhymes and the kind of rhythm. And it's illustrated, but the illustrations are not great. And the story is not very interesting. But on the plus side, the anti-environment people did get their... They get their bit in, so.
Oh, great. Yeah, another thing that strike against that book is that Guardbark is a really stupid name. Although, as I was thinking about it, I don't think it's stupider than Treebeard. So I don't know where I fall on this now.
How is this a legitimately controversial book? Just a quick Google search is like, yep, this is super controversial. Is it just because it has a meaning and it's a kid's book and people that bothers people? It's like, well, this should be a kid's book and it should talk down to kids and kids are fucking dumb.
I don't think it was controversial before the internet. Like, this feels like fake controversy.
Well,
right?
Actually, I'm sorry to contradict you there. I'm sorry to be controversial, Joe, but Terry Burkett wrote her masterpiece, The Truax, before really the internet was widespread.
Yes, stupid people did exist before the internet.
Here's okay.
Yeah, they just couldn't talk to each other so much. They had to go to the gas station to
not
meet
as
each
easily,
other.
Yeah.
I think part of why I'm drawn to this book, and maybe part of why it's controversial, is I feel like it's one of the few Dr. Seuss books that has a hard and fast moral. So many of his books are these gentle parables, and this book is just like straight up political.
Yeah.
It's like saying,
here's the message.
Yeah, like hardcore.
Bam.
If you cut down the truffula trees, all of the beautiful animals and stuff will go and it'll be miserable. And I think that kind of like throws people for a loop because you grow up. Like literally, this book was published in 71. By this time, Seuss had been publishing for more than 30 years, More than 30 years. Yeah. So people have grown up on him, and for all of a sudden him to out himself as one of these tree huggers, that's going to throw people off. They're not going to like that.
So maybe this book was so overt that even the dummies picked up on it. Like normally what you're saying is that, like, if a piece of art has a message, it's maybe not so overt, and so only the smart people get the messaging. But you're saying this one is so overt, so out of left field, that, like,
you didn't need a degree in metaphor to understand this.
Yeah.
Right.
An honorary degree in metaphor.
Honorary degree in metaphor.
So, hey, Ian, what's this book about? why don't you bash us over the head with its lesson?
It's a story about, the frame narrative is there's a boy who goes to meet a mysterious character called the Onceler. And the Onceler tells his story of coming to the area and finding a beautiful tree that has really soft foliage, and he cuts the tree down, turns it into clothing, and somebody buys the clothing from him. And then he decides basically to become a small business owner, and he cuts down all the trees. I guess we're alienating small business owners today, but he cuts down all the trees to make his products. And then eventually all the animals that lived in the trees go away. There's this character who speaks for the trees, the Lorax, and he's grouchy and he has a big old mustache, and he tells the Onceler, stop this. But the Onceler doesn't. And finally, the last tree is cut down. The last truffula tree is cut down. The Onceler gives a final warning and lifts himself into the air by the seat of his pants and flies away. And then we cut back to the present, and the Onceler is saying, yeah, I kind of messed up, and now the whole land is grim and gray and sad. Maybe that's also why people don't like it, because it presents like this is ecological collapse. This is catastrophe. It's almost like kind of post-ecological apocalypse.
It's kind of a downer.
It is. Like many books on this podcast, it is.
Yeah, almost downer. All of them.
Yeah, like so much literature. Do you guys know, like, are you aware that Easter Island has no trees on it? Is this obvious? Like, do you know this?
It's just heads.
I think I've heard that before.
Yeah, so this is, it's what this reminds me of right away. So Easter Island is, of course, the island with all of, like, the big stone heads on it.
Yeah, and little bodies. They found the little bodies a couple years ago.
Oh, were they buried? Like, was it like the buried, big head buried above and then just the tiny body below?
Yeah, you didn't see this? It's kind of funny. You can just Google it.
It sounds fake.
Like, a couple years ago, they were like, maybe we should dig around him.
What's keeping him standing there?
Yeah.
Yeah, but apparently they cut down. Apparently, there is evidence that as late as the 17th century, Easter Island was covered in trees. And as of right now, there are no trees on the entire island. And it was believed that they were cut down by the ancestors in order to transport all of those giant stone statues. And so that they actually, like, ecologically depleted their own island in favor of these idols.
These big weird heads.
Just goes to show what happens.
Ian.
Yeah.
Now, this is a personal question.
Yeah.
Not sure where you stand on this, but are you pro environment? Or where do you kind of stand on that?
It's pretty political, Ian. If you don't want to answer, if you're not comfortable, we get it.
I hate to put you out there like that, but where do you stand on this?
Are you trying to get Ian canceled?
This is a test.
As previous books that I brought to the podcast might suggest, this is an issue that I care about a lot. So, yes, I am in favor of having an environment. Much like Dr. Seuss, I think the message.
I love it too.
So, okay, folks, this is the strange thing about this book. And we talked about a little bit about it with the sort of the power of the message. It's really interesting that this book chooses to make a very concrete political point with fantastical silliness. Like it's Seuss. So of course there are things like Thneeds and truffula trees. Like the story is couched in this colorful, bright, funny weirdness. It's like the Seuss thing. But there's a balance here between entertainment and education. Do you guys know who Horace was, the Roman poet? Does that name ring a bell at all? Horace?
I'm picturing a bust in my mind. Yep. Like I'm picturing like a bust. You know how they all look alike? Like they're all just kind of white and they don't have eyeballs and they're, right. That's what I'm picturing.
Are you saying horse?
He was a horse. He was a poet and he was also an equine. No, this is a Roman poet named Horace. He famously wrote some poems called odes, which were extremely lascivious. But the point I want to bring up about him was he had this claim about poetry. It's become known as the Horatian platitude because everyone kind of espouses this. His idea about poetry is that poetry should be both instructive and delightful. It should entertain and educate. Any poem, according to Horace, or any art, which it only does one or the other, is subpar. So if you've got a poem that's only fun and doesn't teach you anything, it's subpar. If you've got a poem that's only teaching and no fun, it's subpar.
So secret learning.
Secret learning. Yeah. Like this is secret learning, but he says it has to be both. It has to be legitimately fun. And so I feel like this is a good way to understand what's going on with this silliness. With this book specifically, but with all of what Dr. Seuss is doing, I guess the where I wanted to go with this is kind of
where are you going with that?
I want to ask you guys a question. Something? Okay,
how is that connected to this book?
Well, I think one of the legitimate questions that I have about this book has to do with Santa Claus. So if there are any kids listening, kids, turn the podcast off right now because we're going to say some things about Santa Claus you don't want to know. So some kids find out pretty young that Santa doesn't exist. I think there's some knowledge which kids don't need. Kids, I don't know, maybe they're not mature enough to handle it. Maybe kids just shouldn't like realize certain things about Santa Claus, or maybe environmental collapse. My question for you guys is this a good thing for kids to know? Like, should young children, the kind of child that would enjoy the Lorax, is that legit? Is this a conversation to have with a child? If you cut down too many truffula trees, all the animals and birds will go away.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I actually...
Joe's going to disagree.
Well, no, I don't disagree.
This is the Looney Tunes principle. It's a very basic principle. It says that any programming should work at both the child's level and the adult's level, and they're going to laugh at the completely different things.
Okay.
And that's why it's good, because you love it when you're a kid, and then you grow up and realize it's still good, but in a completely different way. That's why these things are iconic.
So you're saying, like, it's kind of like showing your kids Looney Tunes and explaining all the sex jokes.
What?
Like, is that what you're saying? Like, that's what the Lorax is?
Nobody said that. Well, no, I'm saying, God damn it. No, it grows with you, you buffoon.
Well, but what Ian's saying is when you sit down and you read the Lorax to the kid, like, the Lorax is enjoyable for a kid. Like, a kid can sit there and it's, like, kind of a fun little bouncy rhyme and the pictures are pretty and the colors are nice. But what Ian is saying is, should the Lorax be instructive for kids? Am I right, Ian?
Yeah, kind of. Like, do we really want to load kids up with this? And I'm not trying to say, like, no, I don't think I know the answer to this question. And by the time this is released, I will most likely have a child born of my own. So, like,
congratulations, Ian.
Thank you. So, like, I don't know.
Get to the question. Do you have to read this to your child and explain to them that the world is going to come crashing? I don't know. That, I think it'll be fine.
The world that you have brought them into is crumbling at its very foundations.
Sorry, kids. Yeah, you should teach this book. It's a really good book. It's a great lesson that as soon as they can wrap their head around it, they should probably embrace, because it's only good things can come from that.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Thank you for that clear answer, folks. I appreciate it.
While I deliberate, do you want to hawk this show?
Yeah.
Ian?
Hawk it. I'll hawk it. Hey, Litheads, it's me. You're the Hawkman. I'm Hawkman from the television show Legends of Tomorrow. Also, DC Comics. I'm infringing so many copyrights right now, and I don't care. We'd love to have you get involved with directing the course of this show. And the best way for you to do that is by suggesting books to us. One way you could do it that I've mentioned a lot is going to our website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com, and clicking on the submit a book button. You can also do this in a much more direct and social way by hitting us up on Twitter or Instagram at youdontknowlit. And you can tweet books at us that you want us to, or maybe their titles. Don't tweet the whole book because that would be super long. Tweet the titles of books that you want us to talk about on this podcast.
Joe, you lose. Only because this podcast, hey, Litheads, this podcast takes a couple things seriously. all kidding aside, and one of them is secret learning. We love it here. We love secret learning. In fact, it's... just speaking for one out of the three people on this podcast, it's really the only type of learning I like.
I can second that.
Ian, if you could please read us a quote and secretly teach us something, that would be wonderful.
Okay. So here's my last word.
But make it secret-y.
Yeah. Oh, it'll be so secret. Yeah. Sort of. After the Onceler has cut down all of the truffula trees and he's scoured the countryside and the Lorax has left, this is how the Onceler kind of closes up this this story. And it's familiar, but it's a great ending to this book. So here we go. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with the one word, unless. Whatever that meant, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago. But each day since that day, I've sat here and worried away. Through the years, while my buildings have fallen apart, I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, says the Onceler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
Thank you.